can only coexist. I find a great many young architecture students talking about just using tension. Tension can be at high tide and compression at low tide of visibility, apprehendability. That's all. They always and only coexist. Find the same way that concave and convex always and only coexist. You strip the rubber glove off your left hand and now it fits your right hand. The concave has become the convex and vice versa. These things are interchangeable. The tension could become the compression, vice versa. But they always and only coexist. We find the proton and the neutron always and only coexisting. We find action, reaction always and only coexisting. Always and only. Now, I've given you a number of always and only coexisting phenomena, and I'm going to group those all together in what we call the theory of functions. The theory of functions we have then, X will stand for one and Y for the other. So X stands for tension and Y for compression. X stands for convex and Y for concave. X for proton, Y for neutron, and so forth. Now I'm going to wrap that all up in just one word and call it relativity. And relativity, you can't have relativity without some relationship involves at least two variables. Then I'm going to have another word which is complementarity, and that involves two. But complementarity and relativity are not the same, so I need something, I would like to brace those together, and I use the word universe. I started off by saying to you, I take a piece of rope, and I didn't have a piece of rope at all. Nobody said, you don't have a piece of rope, and you say it's not manila, or you didn't ask me what it's made out of. We have in literature expression generalization, which means covering too much territory too thinly to be convincing. In science, a generalization, a scientific generalization is discovering a principle that holds true in every case. If you ever find an exception, it's no longer scientific generalization. It is a first degree generalization for me to say, I take a piece of rope. You allow me to do that. I didn't say what kind, what shape, or how old it is, what diameter. You've all had so many special case experiences of ropes, probably almost none of them the same ropes. But I have, so long as I don't say anything regarding this rope that is contradictory to any of your experiences, you allow me to keep on in that first degree generalization. It's a second degree generalization for me to discover the always and only coexisting tension and compression. Is a third-degree generalization to develop what they call the theory of functions, where I have a generalization that embraces generalizations. It's a fourth-degree generalization to say relativity, and a fifth-degree generalization to say universe. Each time you have a more embracing generalization, taking in a plurality of generalizations. Right? A little dog will play a game of tension and compression with you by taking a hold of your leather belt and his teeth, compression and pulling like that, and his protons and neutrons are all coordinating without his knowing it. But there's nothing in our experience of little dog that suggests little dog will ever develop the theory of functions. We discover that what is unique to the brain is it is always dealing in special cases. Every one of those pieces of rope that you've all had your experiences with. You can remember every one of them, practically. Take a little time, you go back. You find that what you do when you're using your brain, you're always retrieving the special case of experience. We find that what mind does is to review all the special case experiences, suddenly find running through it this extraordinary phenomenon of a generalization. I like to speak about a generalization a little more on a scientific basis. We have people going through the woods. In ancient woods where there have been great many storms and the trees have fallen this way and fallen that way. You like to go the shortest distance, so you keep on this way. And you're climbing over trees and doing it. And you're on a tree and suddenly as you go out here, you find yourself going down an elevator sort of slowly. Go a little further, you see you go faster, step back, it gives a stop. And you try that a couple times, you wonder why that's happening. So you look back here, and the tree you're on is lying across another tree, but the other end of it is under a very large tree. As you come out here, you see that enormous big tree lifting. You say, I couldn't lift a tree that big, so you go over and try and lift it. Can't move it. Come out here, sure enough, you're moving it beautifully. So I think the man who first found that, dragged that home, And he thought he had a magic tree. Now, and I say, it was not until 1,000 years later some wife said, "Darling, I think any tree will do." Then you discover it doesn't have to be a tree of wood, it could be made out of steel. I want to get out what we then call being by a generalized principle. The lover is very beautiful, typical of it. All right? So we have then mind is unique in discovering the generalized principles, and the brain deals with special cases. Now, I'll want to look for that function of man and universe. We find, as I also mentioned earlier, every local system is entropic, giving off energies and giving them off, because each one has different rates of turnings and all kinds of complexes of frequencies. The energies that's given off are given off very diffusely and disorderly. Because they're given off in this diffuse and disorderly way, they take up more and more room. Therefore, we have an continually expanding physical universe, and increasingly disorderly. We have found in fundamental complementarity that any fundamental phenomena has a balancing, though it may not be, it's usually not a mirror image, a counterpart that counters it. Therefore, it becomes logical to assume that if we have a physically expanding and increasingly disorderly universe, there must be a phase of the universe where the universe is contracting and becoming increasingly orderly. Now, you can't find that by looking at any of the stars, because the stars are stars because they are giving off that energy in this disorderly way. So, where do we look? Well, one place we could look is our own little spaceship Earth, where we have some first-hand information. We find our spaceship Earth in the geophysical year was receiving some many thousands of tons of stardust daily. We find enormous amounts of energy being impounded from all the stars as cosmic radiation, but by far the largest amount of energy coming to us from the Sun, at 92 million miles away. We find that energy from the Sun and the cosmic radiation being impounded. You get the Van Allen belts, and then the atmospheric layers, the ion, and so forth. There's a continual refraction or bending of that radiation, so it gets tied up into local knots. It hits our water, and three-quarters of the Earth cover the water, and you just look into the water, and you have an oar or some wooden piece there, you see how the refraction or the bending of it. So you see how that energy hitting the water just doesn't bounce off and get reflected off like a steel ball, but gets impounded in the water and heats the water up. The atmospheres get heated and develop all kinds of turbulence of the atmosphere. The energies that heat then get impounded into our Earth. You and I cannot take on energy to regenerate ourselves through our own skin from the Sun. But the vegetation is all designed to do it for us by photosynthesis, as algae in the sea or as the vegetation up on the land. In converting the Sun's energy by photosynthesis, the way it is done is then by developing beautiful molecular structures. Here suddenly we take really chaotic receipts and convert them into beautiful, orderly structure. Here's the beginning of anti-entropy, order. We find all the biologicals continually developing these beautiful molecular structures, and all of our growth is beautiful molecular structures, highly orderly, and most orderly kind of species and everything. Everything coming out is order here. We find energy collecting and in crystallographic forms. Now, I find then that all the biologicals are anti-entropic, and amongst the biologicals, we have the human being. And the human being, while we had, I've given you a physical orderliness in the beautiful molecular structures, we find, I just gave you how the mind works in this first and second and third degree generalization. So we find the human mind taking all these random receipts and gradually converting them by enough of the special case experiences, finding these generalized principles. And I gave you a pyramiding of first and second three, so you finally get to one word, universe, and you can't get more orderly. You're at unity. I see then the metaphysical being the quintessence of the balancing of the physical. We have the physical disorderly and the metaphysical orderly. The metaphysical function in the universe is then to collect, aggregate, and find order, and dispose, sort. This is a great drive we all have while you're sitting there really talking and thinking through with me, because you want to put things in order this way. Right? I find then there's a very important aspect of such order. I'm going to give you, looking at this system over here, you see here a hexagon. No, I don't have, where do I have a hexagon? Can you see a hexagon back in there? You can conceive your hexagon all right. A hexagon consists of six equilateral triangles. A hexagon, if we have the radii and the chords, all the radii are the same length as the chords. If we have what we call a force diagram, I'm going to have a diagram of explosion. I'll have then the six radii, all arrows trying to get out of the system. They're trying to come apart from one another, to disintegrate. But we have the six equal vectors, exactly the same energy value, going around and overlapping one another and making finiteness and coming back. So the six are exploding, are trying to become infinite, and we find the other six are finite and enclosed and hold together. The same six, even though they're the same value, are in a more effective arrangement, inasmuch as they can close back upon themselves. This would be really the picture of intellect, the metaphysical, cohering the physical. We have a very extraordinary demonstration of that in Dr. Einstein. We have Albert Einstein writing his equation, where he as intellect, metaphysically, takes the measure of the physical. He's able to speak about then our energy universe and two prime behaviors, associative and dissociative. And interchangeably so. And he runs and said, the physical universe is E. On the other side of the equation, I show you that I differentiate it into two prime aspects. Associative is matter, dissociative is radiation. And the amount of energy in the associative is matter, it can be spelled out in the terms not just of the radiation, but because we have an absolute, we have the speed of that radiation, all radiation. So it is a constant. So it is, now it's not just linear, but it's a wave going up. So the surface is always the second power of the linear. So it is C standing for the speed of light to the second power. So E equals M, the matter, to be understood in the terms of C to the second power. And how much concentrated this is, simply the more concentrated it is, that's how much energy it is. Okay, that proved to be correct in fission. Now we have Einstein then as intellect, metaphysically taking the measure of the physical. There's nothing in our experience that suggests that energy will ever write the equation of intellect. These are typical, there are certain very impressive irreversibles. So I'd find here then the metaphysical, though possibly of equal dynamic value, having the cohering capability. Find then the metaphysical, then the integrity of universe seems to be dependent on the metaphysical. The physical would try to disintegrate, become increasingly disorderly. We would have great chaos. All right. I see then the human being as the demonstrator of the metaphysical capability, and therefore there must be a great deal of it in the universe, operative. I find that whenever nature has an essential function, as for instance, in being able to regenerate life on board our spaceship Earth in order to be able to have human life, to have the metaphysical capability in operation, there has to be then the impounding of the energy. And I said the humans can't take it through his skin from the sun, but the vegetation can take it. Now the vegetation, in order then to have young vegetation replace itself, can't have its young in its own shadow because it wouldn't have any sun to impound. Therefore, all the vegetation gives off all of its new life in seeds which it launches into the winds and the waters to remote positions. The probability of all those seeds landing in places where it would be favorable for their growth is very poor. So whenever nature has an essential function and the chance of survival is poor, she makes many starts. This is, then I would say, in order to be sure that there were some planets with metaphysical capability operating, she'd make many starts. I'd have to say, go much beyond Hoyle, who says he has a working assumption there are hundreds of millions of planets with life aboard. I'd say there must be quadrillions times quadrillions. The probability of our little group on spaceship Earth making good is very poor. But coming back then to the fact that we didn't have an instruction manual, it forced us, if we're going to survive at all, to gradually discover that our muscle was as nothing alongside of that lever. And there's nothing alongside of having Niagara Falls landing on top of that lever. That our muscle can't compete with that. That our only real function is here. I find man in his fear today in all kinds of trouble, as for instance, he thinks about automation as something new and threatening. Man has always had automation. All of our tools, our externalizations of originally integral functions. Our vessel became simply extension of our cupped hands. But once I've made hollowed out something to do this for me so that I can free my hands to do other tasks, then I can make it of materials that will handle heats that my hands won't handle, that will handle acids my hands won't handle. I can make it much bigger than my hands. Still, it's the same principle. Our tools get to be more or less unrecognizable in the terms of the original function due to that extension of capability. The same way, for instance, our brains and our computer is simply, we are simply developing a very, by a method, a leverage of putting more energy in, we can retrieve information more rapidly and store it more rapidly. We can have a large, very large bank. But it's the same principle, it's just the brain. It is not mind. Now, automation, we've always had it. Human beings accidentally press buttons and babies get made. They don't know how to make babies. They're all automated. Now, everything about you, all the food that you've eaten, you have a slice idea how you're disposing that to make hair and to make ears and take care of repairs when you scratch yourself. You have a slice idea. You have any idea why you weigh in at 7 pounds and go to 70, 107, or 170, whatever you go to. Have a slice idea. All completely automated. All of you have no idea exactly how it happened that we had oxygen on our earth waiting for the child to get in his lungs when he comes out of the womb. It's all beautifully designed. We have, our whole universe is automated this way. Man's conscious participation is very, very meager. But he's up to yesterday, he has been thinking of everything that reality is only that which you can see, smell, hear, and touch. Very utterly superficially. He was very shocked by both Freud and Mesmer demonstrating that there were subconscious behaviors. But only since about 1930, after World War I, we developed our awareness of what we call the great electromagnetic spectrum. Where here are all the frequencies of all the different metals. And here's where you and I can see. You and I can only see in 1/1,000,000th. We can only tune in directly into 1/1,000,000th of what we now know to be reality. Our brains consist of a quadrillion times a quadrillion atoms in beautiful coordinated behavior. You have nothing to do. Your ability to communicate with me and hear me is in terms of that kind of superb coordination, all automated. So the automation, I just say, we're not used to talking that way. We're not used to the great invisibility. And right now, 99.9%, anything and everything is going to affect all of our lives is being conducted in the areas of the electromagnetic spectrum that are non-directly contactable by the man's senses. So we don't see the things going on. Great tidal waves are coming upon us of change that are completely, because we're relying on our senses, and we still talk and appraise everything in the terms of the superficial, the sensorial. There is an entirely new way in which we're going to deal with one another. And the great ascetic of tomorrow is going to be integrity. How we really deal with the invisible information. in respect to one another. But in the South, it tends to be self-policing because the data on the extraordinary numbers that you find there, the instrument is giving you, you don't really know the significance. There's no way for you really know how to falsify it or to turn it to a bad account. You have no reason to turn it to a bad account. There, it all really has a self-policing integrity, all that information itself. Now, in the way I'm talking to you, I find our society doing various things, as for instance, there's a hierarchy of events that I find very, very important. Each human being is born with the ability to apprehend, comprehend, employ information. And yet it gets greatly discouraged very early. There are, in each age, those who do not get hurt too much and they still deploy it. I'm going to call this man, he's a combination of something we will call an inventor, discoverer, scientist, artist. He's inspired, he sees these things and he employs that information and he does something with it. And he alters the environment. He is the man who initiates altering the scenery. Just does it very spontaneously. Every child really tends to do that, but he does it, keeps on doing it when he's grown up. Now, those have been the men who, through the ages then, have brought about rearrangements of the environment to ever-increasing advantage of society. I'm going to take the economic patronage of those men, the economic patronage of this artist, scientist, inventor. Go to the earliest times we know anything about. I'm going back to early Egypt. Life was so dismally discouraging to the utterly ignorant man. He's dying at under 27 years of age, probably around 22 years of age, average, having gone through a great deal of disease, uncomfortable, great hunger. That nobody could possibly conceive of life being something worthwhile in its own right. Though you have to say, why are you born? So everybody assumed that the only reason was because there's going to be a life hereafter, and really the worse the life was, the better the life hereafter. But because you couldn't conceive of there being enough for everybody, you could only conceive of being enough for one man. There was the Pharaoh, and he was the one man. So the scientist, artist, inventor was employed to get ready the afterlife of the Pharaoh. Then if he did a very good job, he was lucky enough, and he, the men who worked, the servants, were all going to be killed, and they put in the tomb of the Pharaoh. And today men think of this as something very horrible, but it was not thought of that way. This was grace to be allowed to be, because you're now going to get to that life hereafter a little quicker. In order to be able then to prepare that tomb and everything for the Pharaoh's afterlife, there were a great many stones to be moved, and so the artist, scientist, inventor saw that he could make that ditch from the Nile, and that he could grow a little more because he had to feed those men while they're moving the rock. So he altered the environment, and it could take care of more people. But after the Pharaoh dies and everybody's been put in that tomb, the ditch is still there, and things keep growing. So gradually the environment got altered enough so people began to say, well, maybe we could also take care of the afterlife of the nobles. So that's what they did. So there's a period of the artist scientists being employed to take care of the afterlife of the nobles. Then gradually they said the environment got continually changed and altered more favorably. They said, well, there could be enough here for the afterlife of the middle class. As we come into our Greek history and Roman history, it was the afterlife of the middle class. The lower class, the slave, just didn't count. The Greek, you were thinking about a democracy, but that only was, that they did not include the slave. He just didn't count. There was enough to think about him. Then we have the period of the great prophets of Buddha and Muhammad, Christ. And this is the point where they begin to talk about it could be the afterlife of everybody. And And we have all our great Middle Ages, the great cathedrals, of when we have it getting ready for the afterlife of everybody. You see, people really in abject poverty, but that didn't bother at all because they were getting ready for that afterlife, but now everybody's in on it. With the continual developing of more and more tools and rearrangement, suddenly said, well, now we've taken care of the afterlife of everybody, we could even take care of the living king. And then they got a little more rearranged and said, well, now we can take care of the living nobles. And that's the time Magna Carta. Then we have, well, there's enough here to take care of even the middle class life as well as the afterlife. And that is really right up to yesterday. Then it came to the point and said, well, it looks like we might even be able to take care of everybody. But the scientist, artist, inventor said, up to now, the scientist, artist, inventor had always been making one off with his own hands for the patron. He said, there are not enough artists to make for everybody. So the artist, scientist, inventors invented mass production, or they made the tools, and the tools would make the end product. But you couldn't have mass production without mass consumption, and you couldn't have mass consumption without mass buying capability, so labor did a very extraordinary job in fighting for the very enormous increase in the earnings to have buying capability. Having done that, it then felt in a position of protecting, and they had, of course, labor organized fear, organized abysmal fear. And so you had to really get together and have massive resistance to the exploitation and your early death. So I see now labor in fear opposing automation for fear it is going to, because we had all the time the Malthusian working assumption, there's nowhere nearly enough to go around. Everybody's supposed to die. Every once in a while somebody proved that he was able to work through, so that there are a few who could work through. So I see that what we're coming into now is an entirely new era where man is discovering that what he has is mind, his counts, not his muscle. We're going to have to be much more daring. I give you very good news. I was asked to speak 2 weeks ago to the annual meeting of the, I think it was the annual meeting, seemed to be, the executive committee of the United Auto Workers, and Walter Ruth asked me to speak to them. And these are the heads of all the United Auto Worker sections around the country and around the world. They all came together in one meeting. And I was asked to speak to them. I talked to them about, as I'm talking to you now, for 3.5 hours. I said, Walter, you are well known as the most liberal kind of labor leader, and the world knows you well. Your record is high integrity. And what you're going to have to do is to say to the world, on behalf of labor, that labor is not afraid, and it understands that we have the wealth and capability, and that what we're going to have to do is to give, as we did with the GI Bill after World War II. World War II was a very extraordinary moment, incidentally, because after it, we had coming out of the service all our young people, all in their prime, and you couldn't say that they were all, they didn't have jobs because they were no good. And we developed all kinds of automation in order to be able to develop, to win the war. And so the jobs weren't there. So what we did is to create a GI Bill. We sent everybody to school. We sent everybody to think, to use the one thing we really have. Not the muscle, but here. And nothing has ever paid America off as that GI Bill. So I said, you are going to have to say to America that labor is now asking that man. We didn't like the idea of a dole. We didn't like the idea of a great pirate who was handing something out to you. But if you discover that the wealth was not from some other man, but it's in your environment waiting for you to employ it, and when you give everybody a fellowship to go back to school, you're going to give everybody a fellowship to think. And your fellowship will give you anything, everything you need. You say, right, I'm going to go fishing. You say, all right, that's fine, that's a great place to think. And while you're out there fishing and thinking, the first thing you can think about is when you get through fishing, you don't have to go back and try to displace some other man. Nor do you have to try to count out of this man in order to be able to be sure their family is going to eat. Not worry about that ever again. And you're going to say, what was it I was thinking about before I was told I had to earn a living? That was fascinating me so. Now, we talk about, I'll just point out certain things that are very surprising that are going to happen, because we have a very inferiority kind of a complex about we have to earn that living. Everybody has to have a job. So we've gotten up to, we really invented since the New Deal, the 70 million jobs. And they really are inspectors of inspectors, and people are making machinery of inspectors to inspect inspectors. Just in order to be sure to have jobs. And the point is that we're generating so much wealth, we can afford to do it. But we're kidding ourselves by making the job. So we have the man competing against the machine, and he just can't compete against the machine. His muscles are just not good. He just can't reflex as fast as that computer can reflex. So he's holding down the, impairing the wealth. We now know that what wealth is ability to regenerate forward life. And we've organized ability. How many people can you take care of for how many more days? This is what our wealth is. How many degrees of freedom? How much can you accommodate their needs to move from here to there? Have you got things organized to do so? That's what we mean by wealth. We find then that the wealth consists of energy. Energy associated with matter, energy associated with radiation, and the energy part of wealth is conserved. The other part is the metaphysical or the intellectual. And every time we use our experience, we always learn more. Every time you make experiments, you have to learn more. You can't learn less. We find the metaphysical part of wealth is continually increasing. The physical can't decrease, therefore, wealth consisting of the metaphysical and the physical, it can only increase. It's something we didn't know before. There it is, we're confronted with it. So what we want man now is to stop competing with machines, so allow the machine to generate that wealth advantage higher, faster, and more, much more rapidly. And that's just what we will have to do in our final emergency if we really do pull out. And we think about all the urban problems and mess and bad environment. We have almost all of our cities, grown up originally around trading routes. And then there came the man who came around and said, "I see you boys need protection," and he built a wall around it. And then he had his strong men, and they divided up all kinds of spoils in the system. They own that land and so forth. And we have all kinds of confusions of survival. But I find that in all of our great cities, we have long ago laws were enacted, said that it's immoral and unhealthy to work and sleep in the same place. So you have to have a place where you sleep and a place where you work. That's meant that you had to use twice as much real estate. It was a very good idea for the people who own the real estate. At any rate, we've now built fantastic buildings for all the make-do work, for everybody to have jobs. And we have all the beautiful plumbing up there, and the people don't sleep there at all. They sleep over here. So we have all the typewriters sleeping with the beautiful plumbing, and all the people are sleeping in the slums over here. The minute we say we're going to give everybody fellowships, everybody's just going to leave those kind of jobs. all the automation will then go down in the cellar, and all the people move out of the slums up with the plumbing. But this is it. This way it can go. I want you to realize it really can be done overnight. It really can be done overnight. Well, I've given you a really very comprehensive view, but I was able to get to the total variables and begin to really find out nothing escapes us. We really understand what our wealth is. Just to give you a little comfort in your own right about it is possible to take care of everybody, I'd like to talk about something that you're not familiar with, which is called mechanical efficiency. In engineering, mechanical efficiency refers to the amount of energy work being done by a given machine out of the amount of energy it consumes. A reciprocating engine of all of our automobile engines, reciprocating engines with a piston, are only about 15% efficient. And fairly easy, you can see why. You have an explosion on top of the piston, and it's connected by a connecting rod to the crankshaft. So you have an explosion on top of it, and it goes down like this, and the crankshaft sends it right back where it came from. So it immediately frustrates you, send it this way, it comes back. Contradiction. So that's 15% efficient. Now we have a, now it's still a connecting rod, but to a fixed shaft instead of a crankshaft. have explosion on the side instead of top here. It keeps going around, now it becomes what you call the turbine. It's what you call 180-degree restraint instead. This is 180-degree restraint in the reciprocating engine. It's a 90-degree restraint in the turbine. So it keeps on going around at least the same direction. And it is 30% efficient, just twice as efficient as the reciprocating engine. Then we have an explosion without any of those restraints in the jet engine. It goes to 60% efficiency, or double again. We get to what we call the new fuel cells and so forth, and we're getting up to 85% efficiencies. I want you to realize that there are these higher efficiencies available in a design revolution. And we're really, our overall operating economy, our overall efficiency of all the machinery man's using today and the way he is using it, is only about 4%. That's all we're getting. We're wasting 96%. At all times, there are more, in the United States alone, there are more than 1 million cars standing in front of a red light with the engine going. 24 hours a day. We're averaging 100 horses jumping up and down, so 100 million horses. And we're taking that oil from Arabia and having the Arabians and the Israeli kill each other over the way we're using that kind of oil. That's just to get a little idea. When I talk about it is feasible, it is eminently feasible from an engineering scientific viewpoint with what we now know about our physical universe, what is there, it is eminently feasible to take care of all of humanity at a higher standard of living than anybody's ever known. Within each of the countries that are industrialized, a very extraordinary thing has happened. Our first census of the population of the United States was 1790. We had, however, had people here, Europeans, coming for a long time, and had the Indians here long before. I was interested to find out, if I could, about what kind of population we had in the early days, and I found the only way to really find anything out was really in the family Bibles. I went into studies of the numbers of little ships and how many ships brought people here. I found the earliest American families had 13 children per family. That's the earliest colonists. Very frequently, mother died in childbirth and father married again, and so forth. So there's liable to be quite a few widows and widowers, but they accumulate 13 children per family. I found as we put in waterworks and sewers and any kind of advantage for society, down went the numbers of children per family, and up went life expectancy. Life expectancy when I was born was only 42. That's what the insurance companies were betting. It's already gone up beyond 70 for a male. So just in my lifetime, it has doubled. This all come out of this fallout technology we've been talking about, having the refrigeration there, and having electricity or whatever it may be, getting the conditions you want when you need them. Right. I find then that as our technology begins to improve, and this technology gets to be an interrelated technology, which you can use the cup when I'm not using it, you can use the telephone when I'm not using it, you can use the light when I'm not using it, whatever it is, enormous interchangeability, that in this new kind of relationship to our total environment, there is a completely improving advantage for humanity, fundamental advantage for humanity, so that the numbers of babies goes down, and up goes, I said, life expectancy. We've now got the point in the United States where we're down to about the 2 babies, but in the last 4 years, the absolute numbers of babies born has been less each year. It's not less per thousand or a ratio, but literally less babies are being born in the United States each year. This is true not only here, but in all the industrial countries. It's true in Russia, it is true in all through Europe, all the industrial countries, and China. And China has now instituted birth control in a very important way. Japan is the first country in the world to completely stabilize their population. I'm finding then that the only place where the babies are increasing very rapidly still is in the non-industrialized countries where chances of life are poor and nature makes many starts. So when the chances are good, she makes less and less starts. Then the question is, how fast do you industrialize? I find that all the population exposure we're having is not because of more babies, but because the people who used to die just didn't die. So for a while, they used to be dying very in the earliest years, less than 5 years old, so we began to have the bulge down there, but that bulge is going forward, so there is getting to be an older and older group. But we get to some kind of a plateau here where we've been making less and less babies, where we begin to somehow, apparently, working towards some kind of keeping the life going. The rate at which industrialization occurs is very important for you to know. What it took, see, each country starts in not where the other one started and copies its whole pattern of industrialization, but starts in where the other one left off. Japan did not start with a twin cloth wing covered biplane. It started at the aluminum Spitfire level. And China starts in with not even a propeller ship, starts right in the jet age. China is coming in with fission accomplished, with the computer there, with the transistor there, whatever it may be. Okay. Now then, what it took England 200 years to accomplish in industrialization, starting with industrialization, was emulated by the United States in 100 years. Russia accomplished the same parity of production within 50 years. China is going to do it in 25. That is, by mid-1975, China will be becoming affluent. As each one starts to industrialize, there's a high priority of steel and energy first, and people are starving, and they have to starve. You can't pay any attention for the moment. So in the beginnings of the industrialization, there is poverty, and the only way that it becomes satisfiable is that you have a working assumption of everybody living at that level, and anybody living at any other level is abhorred. So the attitude of you're hearing expressed out of China towards anything seems to be affluent, seems to be good to talk about that kind of selfishness, but soon they will be affluent themselves. What is happening instead of pulling the top down, we're actually pulling everybody up, with the more, with less thing taking care of more and more. By 1985, after China comes in and doing it in 25, we will have the great majority of humanity industrialized, and the rest will be done in about 12 years. 1985, I expect to see almost complete world stabilization of population. I want you to know some of those figures along with the other things I'm saying to you. I want you to realize that as I talk to you, I'm really not talking, I'm a long time student of the data. And I've been working on general systems theory for a very long time. I've learned how to look at the data not with sides and not with biases. I've been able to unbias myself by discovering, as for instance, that if we're not dealing in infinity, where a triangle or a circle was an area bound by a closed line, you could only accredit on one side of the line as definable, out the other side wasn't definable because it went to infinity. When I'm dealing in systems, when I make a triangle here, there's a great big triangle. There's the rest of the area that's bound by a closed line of three edges and three angles. I see the big triangle. When the man draws a little triangle, I see the big triangle is drawn. It's just as finite also. And by exploring mathematically and physically, there is an inter-accountability that automatically removes the bias. Anyway, I would say to you that as of my kind of inventorying with you tonight, and I find it very necessary to do the best inventorying I could, not to avoid talking about anything. We must be able to inspect anything and everything that we're experiencing. To try to understand it, I find that there is, to me, a dawning of a total awareness that I couldn't talk. I'm not exceptional at all. I can only talk and talk between us as we are able to talk and think. That we're able to talk and think the way I am talking and thinking on our mutual behalf is a very good sign that we are really on the way of our educating ourselves to really discover what it is all about, how we are, how to function. But I expect man is going to find a very important new, we're coming into a new relationship to the universe itself. And I'd like to counsel you one attitude, which is relation to something we speak about as space programs and so forth, which when you talk about on a political basis, say, you can't afford that kind of stuff. Never mind wasting all that money, we say, going to the moon, and let's take care of housing of people in China. When I find people don't even know what a house is, really, they're talking in the terms of something very, very inadequate, not understanding that the resources that we now have, the way we're using them, all the metals which we have mined and refined and put to work do get recirculated. Those metals are now engaged in structures and machinery which, operating at full capacity, can only take care of 44% of humanity. Our resources, the way we're now using them, can only do that. There's nothing can be done politically towards anything else. 56% or the majority of humanity are have-nots and are doomed to very early demise due to the inadequacy of that design level. This is because we're not using the higher efficiency and so forth. So I say, it's a design revolution which we're going to have to go through to get us where we want to get to. You can't get it by politics, because the resources per capita are continually decreasing. We don't have more resources at all. So it is a design revolution. Now, I'm going to give you the following. I am an old-time pilot, and when a young man qualifies to get his pilot license, and then if he wants to go on, he then qualifies to be an instructor, a flying instructor. When I see a young man as a flying instructor dealing with his fellow man, this young man, there's no time in his life when he'll demonstrate greater integrity. His personal awareness of how easily his information he's passing on could be misinterpreted and this man could be killed just overnight like that. That's in a minute. So his sense of the impending death, if he misinforms his student, is so great that his integrity of communicating is very high, highest we'll ever find it. I have a young man who's a mechanic working on an airplane. He certifies that he's done that work, is just as reliable as a great surgeon certifying what he's done. He just would not be able to sleep that night if he said he'd done this, and he knows a man going off an airplane is going to, and the thing is not working, is going to fall out of the sky. I find the same two men, that instructor and the mechanic, will get in their automobiles and go downtown, and then get out of the automobiles and go in the local saloon, and they will suggest that some people are sons of dogs and things like that. They'll be very illogical and unreliable. I find that really the slower people are, the slower the motion, the less consequence they can see. Now, we find men going to sea in ships, and the threat was so great, they began to develop a very high integrity. And the sailor has very high integrity. If one is in trouble, they'll go to the other man's help, even though it's maybe lose their own life. Their meanings, there's never been a place where we had any language so reliable as the green, the starboard and port of ships all around the world. What a buoy, a red buoy and a black buoy mean, that's universal language. Man's integrity is high on that sea, because he could see the consequence of being false. When we began then to fly across the ocean, we had even higher integrity, and very few people fell in the ocean. Compared, if we think about the total miles accomplished over oceans compared to what's been accomplished on the sea, the miles the passengers lost per mile are fantastically low in the air. I find the faster man goes, the more readily he can understand the hazard. So when we get into the rocketry, now, see, we have the ship going this first over the water, then the airplane needing lift like this, then now the rocketry going out against gravity at 100%. And to our imaginations, all the things that could go wrong were so great that we have been so extraordinarily careful. When we have a countdown at Cape Kennedy, it is not from 10 to 1, it is from 10 million to 1. There are 10 million things that had to be done before you take off, and everyone had to be done correctly. It's fantastic. That we have then, when they go into space, just talk about distances, average distance covered in a lifetime up to my father's time was 30,000 miles. I've now covered 300,000 miles. one of those astronauts in 1 week going orbiting here, he makes that 3 million miles. They're getting entirely new magnitudes of motion. That we've had all those men accomplishing all those miles without having lost one man in flight. Nothing has ever demonstrated such integrity of man in his reliableness of what he's doing. Due to what the faster we go, the more integrity is demonstrated. We have never been able to really understand about the metabolic regeneration of man on Earth. We don't know how many trees and how many blades of grass are involved in keeping everybody going, in the interchange of the gases between the vegetation and the man, and so forth. But in order to be able to send man off in space and stay off in space, we're going to have to know for the first time. For the first time, science is going to have to do something understanding man and his process. When we have man stay off in space for protracted periods, and what we've done to make it possible to do it, we'll have to do because of the liftoff. To go out against that gravity, it'd have to be the absolute minimum weight and minimum space. We're going to be forced to not only understand what the regeneration of life is and to serve it, but you're going to have to do it very, very economically. To make man a success anywhere in the universe is to say we can make him a success on the Earth. When we do start making him a success off there and stay in space, all of our satellite relay systems will be working. We'll have at least a billion people watching everything that man does all the time. You have every little kid on Earth seeing this is how you get on with the little black box and so forth. It's going to have to be a perfectly good day's life. And it'll all be done in a little black box, we say, weighing possibly 200 or 300 pounds. Supposing it's 500 pounds. It's going to cost the Russians and the United States somewhere around 10 or 20 billion to get that little black box out. But when it's done, it's going to be reproducible on Earth as any mass production for whatever is $2 a pound. Somewhere $1,000 is going to be the capability which does away with all sewers, water lines, all the mains, all the things that make us umbilical cord people. There's going to be a little black box that makes it possible to take any mountaintop and the rent on $1,000 a year is something very low, so to be able to go on any mountaintop and live in the very highest way. And it'll be absolutely natural for any kid to do it. Anyway, I would say, the only way we're really going to make ourselves success on Earth is by the integrity that we will manifest and only manifest in our space program. So I suggest to you that all support your space programs. It's nothing above everything. It's very extraordinary, but it's the only way we're going to take care of all the people in China and India. Thank you.
Called A Revolution in Design by the speaker was Buckminster Fuller.